Blog Talk Radio.
All right, everybody, it's Monday night, and that means it's time for the Constitution Hour. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Looks like we got a couple in the chat room tonight. I saw Miss Linda in earlier. She must be trying to refresh for her sound. I want to give a shout-out to Rod Luke and Doc and Miss Yola. A lot going on in the news today, guys, and a lot going on around the world. Mainly financial markets getting a little shake-up today with the goings-on over in Cyprus, and it seems like the natives are pretty restless over there on the Isle of Cyprus. I don't know if everyone is familiar with what happened, but it seems that over the weekend, the powers that be decided that a bailout was in order for Cyprus. So, by golly, they decided they'd issue a bailout. And what they forgot to tell the people of Cyprus is, oh, yeah, by the way, when you wake up Monday morning, the bank's going to be closed and we're taxing your bank account at 10%. Don't worry, you can still pull out $50 a day or 50 euros a day from your account until the banks reopen on Thursday. But, you know, whatever money you got in there, we're going to take 10% of it away from you. But, hey, it's going to pay for the bailout, or at least part of it. Don't worry, we'll take the rest from you later. Yet another of the pieces of the puzzle come together. And I want to play a clip for you guys, a couple of clips that I have tonight that go straight to this point. One is, oddly enough, deflation. You know, that's one of the things that we keep hearing about, and there's been a lot of talk going back and forth about inflation, hyperinflation, deflation. And I think it really depends on how you define your terms. As Ron Paul pointed out with Ben Bernanke, Bernanke likes to play loose and fast with the facts or with the definitions, as does any good lawyer. You just change the definitions to suit your need at the moment. Sorry, I had to get a little drink of my beer. You know, Ron Paul famously asked Bernanke, how is it that you can expand the balance sheet of the Fed by $500 billion and yet claim it's not inflationary? Bernanke told him the truth. He said, well, it's simple. We're really just cooking the books. It's not exactly what he said, but it is what he said. He said quite simply that that money was simply sitting on the balance sheets of member banks. In other words, it's just a bookkeeping entry on the bank's ledger. It's not really there. It's not going to be in the economy as a whole. It's just there for appearances. And we have no intention of letting that money go to John Q. Public. No, the bank's going to hoard that money. And so what they're talking about in their mind is deflation. And when the bank talks about deflation, they're talking about the lowering of the price of consumer goods and a contraction of the economy. That's what they're afraid of. They want you and I to continue borrowing money and running up bigger and bigger debts. They want us to live like we are Congress. They want us to amass enormous debt because, after all, our debt is to the bankers. So without further ado, I want to play you this little clip that I titled, well, not that one first, sorry. This is the former head or the president of USB speaking about banking at a symposium in Switzerland.
So I think that we'll start, if I may, with Mr. Grubel, and then Dominic, and Riz Khan. So, Oswald.
We had quite a remarkable time in the last 15 years when globalization really started. And going so far as some people probably today arguing the Communist Party of China is are better capitalists than anywhere else in the world. And that is what you hinted to, what we have to discuss. And normally power is going where the money is going. And we have the West and the industrialized world in the last 10 years alone, I think, we have created hundreds of millions of jobs in the developing nations by outsourcing cheap production and paying with money which we deliberately devaluated as well. So we thought we might be on to a good thing here. And also we forced the developing countries who produced all this wonderful stuff and took our money for it to invest the profits in our treasury bonds so that we can go on spending. And that seems to be, if you keep going on forever there, a good business proposition. Now, did power actually, and how far did could they accumulate power in the last few years, and will it last? Can a country like China grow at 10% or 8% forever? As we know from experience, that at least is very difficult. So we are already surprised that it lasted as long as it did, the growth. What we also did, we engineered a world financial crisis. And again, it was not only the banks. There were governments and everybody was in there. But the politicians cleverly blamed the banks for it. Now, what are we doing? And the solution we have for that is suddenly we have to increase liquidity substantially at banks, and has already been. Most banks half their balance sheet. We will increase capital, double capital at banks, and under Basel III by 2019. So I would think in the next 10 years, at the end of the 10 years in 2019, you will have overly liquid, overcapitalized banks, but till then, very little economic growth. On top of it, you have through the transparency we created in government finances, especially in Europe, astonishing revelations, and which are not inflationary, they are deflationary, substantially deflationary. So we will see if these emerging economies, how they behave and how much they can actually rely on their own economy within the country and what they have established so far, how they will be faring there. So I would say at the moment the judgment is still out of a power shift, and for the next 10 years will be very important.
Sorry, I had my mic on mute. Okay, so what we were hearing there, let's review what the guy was saying, because I understand with his accent, it was might possibly be a little difficult to pick up what he was saying. We're talking about the president of UBS, one of the largest banking conglomerates in the world, at a symposium in Switzerland. And they're discussing what's occurred, and he said, of course, the last 15 years has been quite exciting. Pretty much when globalization really started taking off. So we've got the last 15 years, globalization. He goes on to say that we've invested in third world countries, industrializing these third world countries. Where have we heard this conversation before about UNIDO, right? We know that UNIDO is a UN program. We know when it started in earnest. And of course, we know that under the Reagan administration, he urged the Senate to pass UNIDO. So here you have the other side of that equation, which is the president of UBS explaining what a grand time and what a grand scheme they have in the industrialization of these third world countries. And not only did they rack up huge debt through the World Bank and the IMF and then loan it to these countries to create their own infrastructure and industrialize these countries, but they also, as part of the deal, told these countries that when they made money in this, they had to reinvest that money into buying government securities from the very countries that were supporting this ideology, i.e. they had to buy U.S. Treasury bonds. Isn't that awesome? So by financing their debt with our debt, they had to agree to finance our debt. Sounds pretty good so far, right? Well, he goes on to explain that, of course, this all sounds like a great proposition, but we also know that it can't go on forever. Countries like China, who were expanding massively. How long can China continue to expand at 10%, 8%, 7%? Well, we know that it's not indefinitely. Then he goes on to say, we created or engineered the world financial crisis. It's a plain admission. He's telling you that through this mechanism, they have engineered the world financial crisis. And that we're reaching a critical mass. Wow, what have I been preaching for the last several years on here? It's the monetary system. It's the monetary system. It's the monetary system. There goes that dead horse again. The poor thing probably doesn't have any flesh left on its bones at this point. So here's an international banker at an international banking symposium telling the other bankers, in case they weren't privy to the whole deal, hey, we engineered this whole thing. But then he goes on to say, but we had help. It wasn't just us alone. We can't blame just the bankers because we had plenty of governments willing to go along and still willing to go along. And so they have. And so they continue to go along. Boys and girls, things are getting very interesting. And if you heard the timeline he was talking about, he said in the next 10 years. Well, when he said that was 2011. That's when that meeting was. So he was talking about by 2019. And he used a term in there, deflationary. Right? He said this is going to be deflationary, not inflationary. What he was specifically talking about was the austerity measures in the Eurozone, in places like Greece, Cyprus, Spain, Portugal, Italy, France, Germany, Denmark, Malta, all these places, you're talking about a deflationary problem. Well, again, we're back to that definition. What the bankers mean when they say deflationary is that there's not as much money in the hands of John Q. Public. And the result will be exactly what the gentleman was telling you, that in the next 10 years, probably by 2019, we will have very little, if any, economic growth in the system over that period of time, and we will have banks and financial institutions that are overcapitalized. Let's translate that. We're taking all your frickin' money, and we're going to hoard it. And you're going to pay through the nose for all this engineered crisis. That's exactly what he's telling the public during this symposium. That's a deflationary cycle. And of course, part of that deflationary cycle in our country and many other countries around the world is taxation. They're just going to tax you out of any money that you have, one way or another. It's really that simple. If you don't believe in debt slaves, you soon will. And what happens when the people have had enough? Well, if we look at some of the reports coming out of Cyprus today, people are rioting. They are firebombing. They are PO'd. That's only the tip of the iceberg. What happens in the U.S. of A. when the EBT cards no longer work? I'm telling you guys, this is only setting the stage for a reset. That's all this is. And everything else that you hear and read about, while they are important issues to us, social issues, like abortion, like gay marriage, and all these other things, those are simply distractionary measures. Those are things to keep you distracted from what's actually going on. I'm not saying that those aren't important issues socially, but we've got a much bigger battle on our hands. A much bigger battle. And you're right, in a sense, Doc. Doc said short term, the Cyprus thing will benefit the U.S., but I see it as only marginally. And here's why. If you look at, again, going back to the currency, remember I've talked about you paying attention to the currency market. And we've seen today that the dollar is increasing its strength. But again, it's relative. The Eurozone, you look at where this crisis is centered. It's in the Eurozone. And I want to read you some statistical data. We all know, or should know, that the younger generation is our future, right? If we look to the future, we have to look at the younger generation, those coming of age right now. So let's take a look into our crystal ball and see what the future holds just in the Eurozone. In the Eurozone, young people, ages 25 to 18, there are three countries in the European Union where the 25 to 18 age group, their unemployment is at or below 10%. That's Germany, Austria, and the Netherlands. After that, we have Malta at 12%, Denmark at 15%. Then we move over to the wonderful UK. 22% unemployment of all those 25 to 18. In the EU 27, the various 27 little groups, 24%. Ireland, 28%. Italy, 35%. Portugal, 35%. Greece, 53%. Spain, 53%. Does that sound like a bright future? Does that sound to you like the generation coming up? Does that even remotely begin to sound to you like those are going to be happy, productive people? I tell you what's coming. Some very pissed off, very angry, very energetic young people who are going to have an axe to grind. And a lot of them. And it's not merely just in Europe, okay? The same thing's going on here in the U.S. and globally. You look at the Middle East. You look at the Middle Eastern countries. One of the reasons why so many of the young men in the Middle Eastern countries are susceptible to Islam and the whole jihadi mentality are these unemployment numbers I'm reading you. They've been in that boat for decades. There is little or no prospect for these young men growing up over there. They're bitter, they're angry, and they're looking to blame anyone and everyone. Zero opportunity. They have no hope for a future job, a future family. They have every reason to be angry. And of course, who is the biggest scapegoat on the planet? It's the United States. And you know what? We know that we have played a major role in this whole thing. And I want to open up the lines. I believe I've got Mr. Robert on the line with me here. Robert, hello, how are you, sir?
Oh, I heard that thing on Cyprus today, and I just went ballistic. I just couldn't believe my ears, Rob.
Well, you know, isn't it great? Isn't it great that over there, you see, from our perspective, sitting here in the United States, over there, they are in the throes of austerity measures. Meanwhile, here in the U.S., we're under quantitative easing and we're approaching sequestration.
Well, Ron,
now we can't call it austerity measures here because that would be too damned transparent, wouldn't it?
Well, that was, to me, that was like our supposedly bank holiday. Remember Ms. Clinton?
Yep.
The bank holiday? Yeah, that's what it was, right? That was their bank holiday.
And, you know, Cyprus is just having a brief bank holiday. Sorry about the phone ringing there in the background. If I could figure out a way to cut that thing and never have another phone call, I'd be happy. So, what do you think's going on?
You know, it's like putting air in a tire and letting it out. That's all it is.
Well, did you hear that clip? Did you hear the clip that I played?
Yeah, I heard the clip. I got it loud and clear. And I've been droning and moaning for the past almost two years now. I mean, I told you my bank ledger now is three figures for every item I write.
Well,
three,
you know, we've been talking on the show. Michael Magic was talking on his show before. If you got any sense at all, ladies and gentlemen, the only money you've got in a bank is the money you're ready and prepared to lose.
It's inevitable.
I think so. I think the writing's on the wall and been on the wall.
And, you know, it's really sad, Rob, because now, this is like I talk to people and see how they're doing and everything. But everybody, their response is, we're just getting by. You know, we're just getting by. That is the answer people are giving me.
Well,
get by.
You know, now here's the thing from our perspective, and then this is going back to that definition of words. You know, the bankers call inflation one thing, and then they call deflation another thing. Ron Paul asked Ben Bernanke about housing prices dropping, the bottom falling out of the pricing in the housing market. He asked Bernanke if he thought that was deflation, and Bernanke said absolutely not.
Bernanke, in
one breath, he tells Ron Paul at one meeting that inflation is consumer prices rising. Ron Paul says, well, don't you think that if we're going to rely on the CPI, it's a pretty poor indicator because, you know, guys are manipulating the CPI, and we say it's gone up 2%. I say it's at 9%. Let's split the difference. We'll call it 6% inflation. He said, and even then, you don't account for it. And now, when we have the bottom drop out of the housing market and housing prices are falling, you don't see that as deflationary. So it's not something you think you need to guard against, which is part of the mandate of the Fed. It's insanity. They make up the rules as they go along. They make up their own damn terms. You know, that's why I played that clip last week. Words, Mr. Wordsworth. Just words. You know, I mean, look, I'm telling you, I've been telling anybody and everybody that would listen for as long as I can, the last couple of shows, you guys know that I have talked about the fact that we're in a currency crisis, and the fact is that it's a race to the bottom. Plain and simple.
And these other countries are,
they're all too happy to oblige. Okay?
Well, for instance, Ron, for the past 7 or 8 days, the market was doing extremely well, and everybody got back to normal with their 401k plans, and then all of a sudden the stock, just went down again. Now, what do you think that the stock went wild that for that whole 10 days? What do you think? I mean, what's the reason?
Well, it doesn't take a genius to look at the trade volume on the stock exchange and to see where that trade is coming from. And a lot of that trade is insiders selling off. I mean, just plain and simple. You know, the volume, when you look at the volume of stock traded, you know, the volume is a pittance compared to what it was back in 2007 or 2006 when the market hit its peak. It's a mere pittance of what it was. So the game is up, I'm telling you. It is absolutely up. And I want to read something to you. And this is something that I got in an email. And I don't agree with everything the gentleman is saying in here, but I do agree with quite a bit that's going on. So I want to kind of backtrack a little bit for those that weren't around or those that may not know, and kind of give a synopsis. I'm not going to go all the way back to, you know, 1913 and the Ponzi scheme known as the Federal Reserve. I think we all kind of understand what happened there. So I want to fast forward to 1944 and, you know, winding down the, you know, we're approaching the end of World War II. Okay. And the U.S. dollar becomes the world reserve currency. And how did that happen? Well, it was the Bretton Woods Agreement, okay? And the Bretton Woods Agreement, basically, when you hear people talk about a gold standard, and the U.S. should go back on a gold standard, that's probably not what they have in mind. But they don't, I think most don't understand what that gold standard was. The Bretton Woods Agreement was a gold standard. And it was pretty simply this. All of the nations trading together, Germany, France, Italy, Spain, Greece, the UK, the United States, Europe, and the US, basically, all agreed to settle their debts amongst one another in gold. And they agreed that the value of the gold would be fixed at $39 an ounce. That's what's called at par. Well, the U.S., you know, we were running a pretty big expansionary system at that point. And from the end of the war until 1970, 1971, we had a pretty good run. You think about it, you look back at the nostalgia, the 50s and 60s were a pretty big time of expansion. You had a lot of welfare programs that were started, and a lot of things happened in the United States during that time frame. And along about 1971, we were up to our behinds in it. And what I mean by that is our debts, we weren't able to, it was going to be a problem to try and satisfy our debts, in particular to France, funny how that comes full circle, in gold. We were in trouble. So we had what's called the Nixon shock, where Nixon violated the Bretton Woods Agreement. So that actually would have put the U.S. dollar in serious jeopardy, and it would have jeopardized our monetary system here in the United States. But fortunately, we had this guy named Henry Kissinger who had negotiated a deal with the Saudis for oil to sell the Saudi oil exclusively for U.S. dollars. And so that the petrodollar was born. It wasn't backed by gold, but it was backed by oil. Funny thing, right along that same time frame, anybody remember what happened? We had an oil embargo, and it drove the price of oil and gasoline through the roof. That was pretty damn convenient, don't you think? I mean, think about it. You've just negotiated a deal for the Saudis, the largest supplier of oil at the time, to sell their oil exclusively for your paper funny money. And then they put an embargo on you and drive the price up. Well, it benefits them and it benefits you, doesn't it? because they get a higher price for their oil, and you get to shove more debt off on them. And now all these countries around the world are clamoring to have and to hold U.S. dollars so that they can purchase oil, because after all, the Saudis won't take anything else but that. You get what's going on here. And we've got Miss Linda on the line calling in. If I can get this thing to load, I don't know if it's Blog Talk or my computer that's having issues, but it's not bringing her up in the chat room yet. So you had the creation of the petrodollar. And, you know, gas and oil prices just went through the roof. Well, other oil-producing countries followed Saudi Arabia's lead. Naturally, the demand for dollars was restored, and we're off to the races. But as they explain here, in September of 2012, something happened. And that something is China. China inked a deal, you know, and I've talked about this. They inked a deal with Russia for oil. They're bypassing the Saudis. And gee, let's see. We also had who? Iraq? Iran? Libya? What were they all talking about? Well, let's go back and remember. Saddam Hussein, he was talking about selling oil for the Europe. Huh, Hugo Chavez, for that matter. I wonder how many people here know that back in 2005, Chavez dumped $23 billion in U.S. treasuries for euros and told the United States government, if you want to buy oil from Venezuela, you're going to have to do it in euros. I mean, pay attention to the game here, boys and girls. It's not hard to figure out. Miss Linda, I think you're finally on. How are you?
Oh, hi. Fine, thank you. And hello to you and Robert and everyone in the chat room. You know,
hey,
and
Linda.
Then also you've got to remember with that that whole deal with the, I think it was British, the BP oil spill. There was Soros was heavily involved in that. I think Obama was heavily involved in that. You know, telling Venezuela and Brazil that we would be their best customers. I mean, these guys are so they're so
we
corrupt
are,
it's beyond.
Well, look, we're Venezuela's only customer for their oil because their oil is junk, and we're the only country in the world that can refine it and burn it as fuel. You know, you look at the Eurozone, they, you know, there's different grades of crude oil.
Right.
And, you know, so the price here in the U.S. is different than it is in Europe. Europe is paying more per barrel because they use
mm-hmm.
a higher grade crude oil than what we use here.
Wow.
A lot of reasons, but. You know, you look at some of the European auto manufacturers, Mercedes and BMW, they
right.
don't fare too well in the United States because our fuel has such a high sulfur content, and it damages the
right.
engines in their automobiles because they use a high nickel content steel in their engines, and it corrodes the cylinder walls. I know this
Lovely.
From experience, having been in the automotive industry.
Right. Right.
You could go on right now and do a Google search on 96 BMW hard to start extended cranking time, and you'll find that it's because of the high sulfur fuels in the United States eroding the top 2 inches of the cylinder wall, causing low compression and oil consumption and hard starting. But anyway, I digress.
They've got us over several barrels, don't they?
Yes,
well,
an oil barrel to be exact.
Oh, my God. And then when I'm hearing this thing, first thing this morning, talking about what they did in Cyprus over the weekend, and then I know Glenn was tying it in with what was going on. I think it was Germany. There was some people that came here on our own DOJ because they wanted asylum because they weren't allowed to homeschool in Germany. Oh, where did that come from in the 30s? You know, and then so our DOJ's talking the same way as they're talking about everything else. You don't own anything, you know, and that's why I sent you that email. What's next? They're going to take my car because I don't own it?
You don't own your car. I've been trying to tell people this for how long? Look, I'm telling you, you know, I mean, dead serious, and this is an argument that's been had at our state capitol. One of our legislators here who's stepping down after this year, actually stepped down already, Chip Rogers, he and I had this conversation. If I own my car, why do I keep paying tax on it every year? If I own my home and my property, why do I keep paying a tax on it every year? I mean, when I go buy a microwave, I don't get a tax bill in the mail every year for it. If I buy a television or a computer, but, you know, don't put that past them that could be payment.
The fact is, it goes back
to remember when we were talking about the Constitution. And if you read through your Constitution, guys, real simple premise in contract law, something that is conspicuous. All right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to digress a little bit. Open your Constitution, and I want you to read through it, and I want you to take notice of every time the word citizen is used in your Constitution.
Right.
And what I want you to look at is that there's a change that occurs. And the change occurs in the 14th Amendment.
Yes, it does.
Every mention of citizen prior to the 14th Amendment in the Constitution, the word citizen is capitalized, capital C, citizen. In the 14th Amendment and every mention thereafter, the word citizen is all lowercase. Now, that's not an accident. That's not a conspiracy. That's straight out of contract law. It is conspicuous, something that stands out. Something mm-hmm. must have changed to the character or nature of citizen in order for them to change the introduction of the word from a capital C, sovereign citizen, to a lowercase c, subject citizen. That's exactly the change. I'm telling you.
Oh, my God.
And we're only now seeing that reality play out all too familiar right before our eyes.
Exactly.
All these people that have been running around for years talking about, you know, the creation of some straw man through your birth certificate, a corporate personhood, if you will.
Right.
They've all been crazy and insane, and that's not really true. Right up until about now, people are starting to say, well, wait a minute. You know, that actually has credibility, and the law is acting as if that's the truth.
I know. It's frightening. I mean, people are waking up, though. I mean, it's not enough of them, not soon enough, but this is crazy. We are so subjugated already. It's beyond. And like I said, everybody just doesn't know where to turn. And we do understand the monetary aspect of it. But how do you, I think I asked Mike on his show Saturday, how do you get this many people who actually have jobs to not, you know, keep funding these people? You know, that's the problem.
Sure. You know, I said it before. We, the people that go out and work and earn a living, whether it's at a job, making a salary, or whether it's working cash under the table, I don't care. If you're working to earn your keep, you are being productive. You're producing something of value.
Right.
The government system produces nothing of value. They produce debt. And every dollar that they print or create diminishes the value of your labor time. Period.
Sure.
It's a very simple mathematic equation with a lot of zeros.
Yep.
But, I mean, they're plain and simple, you know, they're screwing the pooch.
Oh, yeah.
And we're the pooch.
It's going to blow. I mean, it has to be unsustainable. It's going to happen here. I mean, all these.
Well, of course, it's unsustainable.
Oh my God! I mean, this what those technocrats did in Cyprus is exactly what they're going to do here. I mean, look at Bernanke.
But
he's so different.
Well, you got to understand, and I'm not sure that it's going to go to that level here. You know, if I'm smart, and of course, you know, they don't care. They could burn Greece to the ground. They really don't give a damn. They could burn Cyprus to the to the ocean, they wouldn't give a damn. But there are some places they don't want to destroy, and I think the U.S. is one of them. I could be naive in that, but now they don't give a damn about the people necessarily.
No, no.
But the commodities, the resources, oh, they certainly care about that.
Well, somebody doesn't, because they're destroying the earth as we speak with these chemtrails. I was watching that geoengineering stuff today, which is pretty nuts, and I mean, our own military is doing this, with the, you know, along with the UN and whoever else is involved.
They've been geoengineering forever, and I've said it before. There are so many. It's crazy, and sometimes I catch myself. I'm like, you know, you got to be half nuts to even think about most of this stuff. if you've not, doggone it, Linda, if you haven't seen The Matrix with Keanu Reeves, the movie, The Matrix.
Yeah.
Get it and watch it. You can probably catch it as a rerun on cable now. Okay?
Right.
But the gist of the movie is the allegory of the cave.
Mm-hmm.
What it is this guy, Neo, you know, Mr. Anderson, he's wandering around doing his daily life. He works as a computer programmer at some office, but he knows something isn't quite right. You know, something's just off, and he can't put his finger on it. And he's been hacking into the system and trying to figure out what it is. He knows something's bogus. He's being lied to about something. And on his computer screen pops up a message, somebody typing to him, how far do you want to follow the rabbit? And he's like, what? Whoa, whoa, whoa. Well, then his life starts to go all kinds of crazy. He's at work. And this guy shows up and says, come on, come with me. The cops are there looking for him, and they're going after him for hacking. And I mean, he's freaked out, so he escapes. He escapes with these people. And Lawrence Fishburne, who's the leader, sits him down, and he tells him, he says, okay, look, what I'm about to tell you is going to seem completely unbelievable. But the world that you think is reality isn't what it seems. So here's your choice. You can take the red pill or the blue pill. You can take the red pill and follow me and see how far the rabbit hole goes, or you can take the blue pill and you'll wake up tomorrow and your life will be just the way it was. So he takes the red pill. And what he discovers blows his mind. He was being kept alive in suspended animation in a little cell.
Oh my God.
Machines rule the world, and humans are tapped into the matrix. We're being used basically as batteries. Okay? The people in the matrix, there's thousands upon millions of these pods with people in them. And
oh my
the
God.
Electrical current and the body heat from all these people is generating energy to run all the machines. And
lovely.
All the memories and his everyday life, everything he's doing is all in his mind. He's been in suspended animation in this little gel capsule his entire existence.
And they break
him out of the cell, and now he's breathing air for the first time in his life, and he is absolutely blown away.
Sure.
I'm telling you, it's a movie that everybody should see. Yes, it's sci-fi. But the implication,
the message,
is still there. You are nothing more than a resource for the machine.
Oh, sure.
All your productive energies are being tapped by the machine for its purpose, not you.
It's being drained, absolutely drained.
And you're completely entertained to keep you docile and unaware that you're just plugged into the matrix and being used as a battery. It's pretty bizarre, but it's an awesome movie. And it's, I guess, an extension of the allegory of the cave, you know, Plato's allegory.
That's probably where they got the idea. I mean, that's been around for eons.
Absolutely.
You know, Ron?
Yes, Robert?
In our town, I go to 7-Eleven, right? There's all signs on 7-Eleven. Save our dispatchers. darn.
I didn't know 7-Eleven had dispatchers.
Well, I just thought I missed it. I mean, this sequestration is hitting our town already, I guess. I've never seen that before in my whole life. Save our dispatchers.
Oh yeah, you're gonna hear all this stuff from the left, Robert.
Oh well, they have to sell you on the idea that you're wholly dependent on government, and without them, life is going to cease to exist. I mean, that's the sales pitch, guys. Obama and the crew up there, they want to inflict maximum pain for the minimum amount of government reduction. Any reduction in government should inflict the maximum amount of damage possible to continue to sell you on the idea that they are necessary.
Yeah, they're like the philosopher kings, and they don't like to lose their power. And they have to continue to shapeshift and lie and sell you on this nonsense. And people fall for it, and that's why we're where we are today. It's been going on for decades. My God, nobody's waking up. I mean, there's a few.
I can't help myself tonight. My wife still gives me a hard time about getting sucked into this TV series, The Walking Dead. But my God, it's no different than The Matrix or any of the rest of them. Okay. I mean, you got all these, they're literally zombies walking around out there.
Oh, yeah.
They
I see them every day.
They do not have a flipping clue.
No. But some do,
I'm driving home tonight, and I see this, I'm in a poor part of town, and I see this poor guy walking, and he's thin and gaunt, and he's wearing, this little hoodie shirt, and he just looks up at me with the most hollow eyes. And
I thought to myself,
zombie. The guy's just a flipping zombie.
Probably for the last 3 weeks, every time I go to the market, I usually go once a week, and I'm at the meat counter, and people were gathering and stuff, and these ladies come up to me, they're probably like in the same age bracket that I'm in, and they go, I'm afraid to come here. I can't afford food anymore because they're on fixed incomes, and we've got to talking about stuff, And they do understand inflation. They understand what's going on with the central banks and stuff. I mean, there are more people that get it than don't. This one gal, we actually got into it, and she says, oh, I know what they're doing. She says, they're printing that money, and they're doing this, and they're causing this artificial inflation and artificial interest rates and all the rest of it. She gets it. And I was like, wow, right in my own neighborhood. But, hopefully people are waking up. I know in even my groups that kind of were leaning left are understanding what I was talking about for 3 solid years about Agenda 21 and how this all connects the dots in your city councils, and that they're giving you one grain of sand at a time. They're not going to dump the whole dump truck on you at once, because then you'd wake up too soon and put the kibosh on it. And they are starting to come around and see that I wasn't kidding, that I was telling them the truth, thank God. So now I have some credibility, and I'm just going to keep pushing. In about a week and a half, I've got a meeting to go to, and I'm going to put together one hell of a 3-minute speech, because I'm not holding back anymore. People need to know.
We have a brand new one here in Atlanta. The discussion over the new public-private partnership to build a new stadium for the Atlanta Falcons, and so folks here are going to have to be a $200 million hotel motel tax.
Sure.
To help pay to build a stadium, damn it, people.
Yeah, there was a story out of Oregon that I tried to send around to everybody here in California and to you guys. I don't know how many I got it to, but it was showing the sustainable development nonsense and their corridor stuff, and they're, herding everybody into these high stack and pack buildings. And I'm not kidding you, Ron. They're like apartments, and they're like 200 or 300 square feet max. And they're charging anywhere from $800 to $1,000 a month for these people. I mean, they showed pictures. I sent it to my city council. I sent it to my friends here on Action. I sent it everywhere I could. And I said, you guys better wake up, because this is what you're going towards. I even linked it on the newspaper comment section. I did everything I could. I need to get the word out, because this is crazy. And nobody gets it. Nobody kind of connects the dots. And I did say one time in front of the city council and the whole chambers, and I said, all of these items that you're talking about, you've got them listed separately, but they're not separate. They're all one and the same.
Do you know, Doc asked a good question, and Robert, I'm supposed to ask you if you're planning on coming to our reunion this year up in Indiana.
I try my best because Leonie has some relatives in Indiana that she wants to meet, so
get over there.
Hopefully we'll try to make it. She wants to go. She wants to be. She wants.
Yay!
She wants to,
yay!
We
definitely need a vacation. I haven't been away in so long. It's been a while since I've been away. So
there you go. Doc is asking a good question. You know, I mentioned the Atlanta Falcons needing a new stadium. So I want to help try to put this in a little bit of perspective for you. He says, what's wrong with the Georgia Dome? It's only 11 years old. He's absolutely correct. Here is exactly what's wrong with the Georgia Dome, Doc. What's wrong with the Georgia Dome is there are season ticket holders at the Georgia Dome, and they're locked in for a fixed price for season tickets. A lot of people, okay, that are just average Joes that like to go enjoy the football games. Well, if we get rid of the old Georgia Dome and we build a new stadium, they can now, and I forget, they've got a term for it, but they can corporatize it, okay?
Oh, my God.
So basically they're already planning on pre-selling whole sections of the stadium for corporations, because they'll be the only ones that can afford to purchase
the prices.
Season tickets for what they're going to be charging.
That's what you call a franchise tax.
That's exactly it. And so then they can entertain their wealthy clients.
Oh, my God.
And the average Joe is going to be SOL, or you're going to be sitting in the nosebleed section and paying for it.
Oh, my gosh. That's just evil.
That's what happens when you get these private-public partnerships, which is exactly what they're calling it. And, Linda, you're exactly right on the Agenda 21 front. And, I've told people in the past, Atlanta is one of their what they call charter cities.
Sure. Oh, yeah. I think it's the, if it's Houston or Dallas. Anyway, it's called the Texas Corridor.
Yes, the Trans-Texas Corridor up I-35.
That goes back
to Sintra and the Ferrovial Group. You can look up Ferrovial. It's an Italian company, one of the largest, the largest construction company in the world. They own over 2/3 of the light rail in Europe. They own 80% of the light rail in Brazil and South and Central America.
Jesus.
They own the Sydney Airport. They own all the light rail in England. They own Heathrow Airport. It's insanity. And their lawyer for Sintra is Rudy Giuliani.
Oh, my God.
Whoa.
Law firm in Texas.
Yeah. If you look on the map from the Wildlands Project, this is what you will see. Or you can go to ICLEI or any of them, Agenda 21, and you'll see this map. And it'll have the Texas Corridor. It'll have everything going on in the northwest and the southwest and your area, Florida, and, of course, the northeast. And everything in between is pretty much off limits to humans. And I've been pounding this drum, and people will not wake up. But I'm going to get it. I'm going to get through to them. I'm not giving up.
Does anyone here remember a group named the Branch Davidians?
Yes.
Any idea what happened to their compound and their property? Who owns it by now?
I have no clue.
Some guy named Rick Perry.
Oh my God. Oh my God! What a schmuck!
Did you know that Waco is right on the projected corridor there?
Of course.
Yeah.
They had to get rid of it. Yeah. Oh yeah. They'll find a way to get your property from you. Oh yeah. I know what they're doing.
Waco is straight up right on the map for the Trans-Texas Corridor. Look, this goes back to the SPP.gov
and
the Trans-Texas Corridor. That everybody was fussed about. I know I was jumping up and down about back in 2003,
2004,
2005.
Sure.
In 2005, Bush signed an agreement with Vicente Fox of Mexico and Paul Martin of Canada.
Yep.
And Condoleezza Rice was in charge of the whole thing.
Of course.
And they got so much heat They got so much heat over that that they kind of scrapped it and put it on the back burner.
Yeah, and they took
T-Boone
down their
Pickens,
website too.
T-Boone Pickens, Doc, I'll tell you what he's been up to, and Miss Pelosi invested with him.
Oh God.
The you know, he went on the TV and was talking about CNG, compressed natural gas and liquefied natural gas, and he wasn't T-Boone. He was, I call him Teaspoon Pickens. he wasn't so much interested in producing natural gas, liquefied or otherwise. What he did was bought up the rights to open all the filling stations where you could fill up your new vehicle with the new fuel. And Miss Pelosi invested a few million dollars with him, so she must think it's a good idea, too. I'm here to tell you. And that's part of pushing the global warming scam on everyone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure.
And, you know, Linda, we talked about globalization. I sent you that little clip with Nigel Farage.
Yeah.
Or Farge or Farage, whatever they call it.
Yeah.
And he was complaining about something that you don't hear much about in the Eurozone and in England.
Yep.
He was complaining about immigration and the problem it was creating for them over there. And, gee, what better way to create animosity in a civilization than stuff a bunch of immigrants in there that are sucking off the
tit. Takers.
And exactly. Zombies. And you got everybody else pissed off at them. So you naturally set people at odds with one another. I want to play one more quick clip if I can find it, because I've only got about 3 minutes left. If I can find it, and it was the deflation clip that I was talking about earlier. So it's just 2 minutes. So bear with me, guys. Just pay attention to what's being said here.
Economists estimate a 1% decline in growth in developing countries pushes an additional 20 million people into poverty. And growth is expected to slow in developing countries at a greater rate than previously anticipated, from 6.4% to 4.5% because of financial turmoil worldwide. Already, the World Bank estimates high food and fuel prices have driven 100 million people into poverty.
The crisis is having a destructive effect on third world economies. The International Monetary Fund is warning that the economic downturn could create a widespread humanitarian crisis in the world's most vulnerable countries. The IMF has called on richer nations to raise $25 billion in the next 12 months. But if conditions get worse, the figure needed could rise to $140 billion. As the more developed nations tighten their purse strings, foreign investment is expected to fall by 20%. Money sent home by migrant workers is also likely to decline. There are concerns that social costs of failing economies could cause political unrest and even conflict. It's estimated that if conditions continue to get any worse, anything from 1.4 to 2.8 million children could die between now and 2015. The IMF's managing director, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, revealed the organization's predictions this week and urged the body to stick to its old commitments. He said, after hitting first the advanced economies and then the emerging economies, a third wave from the global financial crisis is now hitting the world's poorest and most vulnerable countries. I urge donors to rise to the challenge and provide the financing needed to preserve these hard-won gains that many low-income countries have made over the past decade and prevent a humanitarian crisis.
Okay, so you hear what they're saying there, guys, and I want you to wrap your mind around this a minute. Okay, they're telling you that there's a financial crisis and it's causing high food prices and starvation and a crisis, and the richer countries, U.S., is going to have to kick in more money to the pot. That means more taxes, more austerity measures, more sequestration for us, right? But at the same time, they're telling you this isn't an inflationary problem, it's a deflationary problem, and it's going to kill 2 million plus people by 2015, and it's putting all these people into poverty. So they're giving you a timeline. The first guy told you by 2019, right? And why is there going to be no financial and economic growth? Because they're going to suck all the economic growth out of the countries that have any kind of liquidity and solvency and put it into these countries that are falling apart. And he even mentions, right, in the first clip, how long will these countries be able to sustain themselves? So they blew up all these bubbles, and now they're going to step back and hope that they don't all pop. Guys, we're in deep stuff. I'm telling you. We're out of time.
Thank you. God bless.
God bless. Thanks for calling in.
Everyone. Bye-bye.
See you.